Hello, and welcome to AI Curious. My name is Jeff Wilser. I'm a journalist, I'm a human, and I am curious about AI. And for some time now, I've been wanting to interview someone who is really at the front bleeding edge of AI tech and AI tinkering and creation and building. Someone young, scrappy, hungry, who's in San Francisco actually building the cool shit that we'll later read about 6 months or a year from now. And it turned out I already knew this person. I first, by a complete coincidence, happened to meet Ian Laffey around two-ish years ago in Denver playing tennis. And confession, Ian kicked my butt. Then again, most people often do, so he's in good company. Anyway, the point is that since that time, he has moved to San Francisco, where he is an AI engineer and now the CTO of a company called Theseus. I'm probably butchering that pronunciation, T-H-E-S-E-U-S. And most importantly for our conversation, Ian was part of a team that recently, in a hackathon, in 24 hours, developed, created, and built using 3D printers a revolutionary type of drone. It's a drone that does not need a signal to locate GPS or where it is. It could somehow basically be off the grid, which means it can't be jammed, which means it could have profound implications in places like Ukraine. This drone that Ian helped build, a tweet about it went viral on Twitter/X. His company is now speaking with powers that be and places in the defense industry. And it's very possible that Ian helped change and transform how drones are deployed in places like the Ukraine war. So it very quickly escalated and their project is blowing up. So we talk about that in detail, and also we get into what it's like at this point in time for someone in their early mid-20s. Ian is only 24 years and graduated school a couple of years ago, maybe less than that. What is it like to be in San Francisco right now in this hotbed of AI hype and craze, how it changes your thoughts on entrepreneurship, on funding, on getting VC, all that good stuff. I think most importantly, this conversation to me felt, Ian felt very real, right? This is very unvarnished, no PR comms speak stuff. This is a 24-year-old genius who is excited about fiddling and creating with AI in the trenches doing it. And I think you'll hear that excitement come through. It's just very real, raw, kind of creating tech stuff. I really enjoyed the conversation. So with all that said, please enjoy my conversation with Ian Laffey, CTO of Theseus and co-creator of a new drone prototype that could transform how drones are deployed in war. Ian, welcome to the pod.
Hey, yeah, good to see you.
Last time we spoke, we met in person after you kicked my ass at tennis. Who would have thought that 2 years later, we would be on an AI podcast discussing how the world is changing?
Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, yeah, it's just like this, the state of the world, I guess.
Since we last spoke, you were part of a team that designed, 3D printed, and built a drone that calculates GPS coordinates without a signal. And you did all that in 24 hours. So let's start by telling us about this drone and the hackathon and how AI was involved.
Yeah, so there's this hackathon in El Segundo, I guess a month and a half ago now. And it was like a defense tech hackathon. So El Segundo is kind of blowing up in the defense tech space, or just like the American dynamism space. I went there, I met up with my best friend flew in from Yale. He's the one that told me about it. And then they always have these little like mingling sessions before a hackathon. And we met this guy, Carl. He's a fourth year Mechie student at Stanford. And he's like, dude, let's build this drone. It should like, he's like, well, what if it used Google Maps? I'm like, man, that's like a fucking genius idea. like, yeah, let's do it.
For those like myself who are not that drone savvy, talk a bit more about why using like Google Maps is kind of like a big breakthrough and how most drones, if not all drones, don't do that, and how they are reliant upon a signal, and how if what you guys pulled off works, that could really change the use case for drones. So kind of what were you guys, what's the current drone problem that your guys kind of prototype was trying to solve?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the GPS systems around the world, they use these like relatively low power satellites. And it's kind of like a consumer grade application. Like basically it's really easy to jam. And what we're seeing today in Ukraine is basically all the drones that they're flying, they're putting together with, again, like consumer grade parts. And so like, we here in the US will have a $2 million missile that can navigate without GPS. And it does a lot of, the Tomahawk missile was kind of the inspiration for our navigation system. But that doesn't work on this like cheap $200, $500,000 drone that has this like Chinese GPS module on it. And so the front lines in Ukraine and basically in any like kind of full-scale conflict today, they're just completely GPS denied because it's so easy to jam that signal. And yeah, so the drones have no clue where they're at in the world, and they fly basically entirely based off like their internals, like based off of inertia, and it makes it really hard to do any sort of like automation, because when people were originally designing the drones, they assume that they and designing the software for the drones, they kind of assume that it has the ability to call home to GPS and that it has a reliable understanding of its location. And anywhere you go in America, like that would be the case. But when you put them up in a place with GPS jamming, that just it breaks that.
Got it. And I'm going to ask a very embarrassing, dumb question. Is this similar to when I use Google Maps, if I don't have service on my cell phone, let's say I'm traveling internationally, right? One of my usual, you know, international travel hacks, and it's kind of obvious, I guess, but is download offline maps on Google Maps. And then I could be in Lisbon. And even if I don't have service in Lisbon, if I've downloaded the map, then I could like look at my Google Maps and get my blue dot around the map to get the red dot wherever I'm going. Is that kind of part of the idea of like being able to, without having service, quote unquote, the drone can know where it is somehow using Google Maps?
Yeah, the super cool thing, and I'll get more into the meat of the algorithm, but the super cool thing is the situation on the battlefield is literally what you're talking about inverted. So they can download the maps, but they don't know where the blue dot is. Because how that blue dot works when you're in Lisbon is your phone doesn't have an internet connection. It can't go and say like, oh, show me pictures of this, but it still knows like I'm at these coordinates, like, you know, 36.35 by, you know, negative 10 or whatever. And so over there, they're just because it's like two completely separate signals, like GPS, internet. Like that's why if you go under a bridge, sometimes your phone like loses where it is a little bit. And so what we did was we basically said, we'll download the Google Maps satellite images, and when you actually put this to use in the field, you need to use more up to date images because in Ukraine specifically, like there's so much artillery that the satellite images are not really accurate on Google. But you take the image and then you've got a camera on the drone, and then it's kind of like, I would say old school computer vision, where you basically like map the two points between them. And so it's like, if I have this mug, like at this point, like computers are pretty good at taking this and then taking like this and kind of saying like, oh, okay, I see the eye, and that's the same point in these two images, or that's the nose. And so that's what we do. But on the Google Maps image, we have all of the GPS coordinates on it. So you can say, oh, okay, that church is at 25 degrees north. And then, so now on the drone, I know that that is the church, and I know that that's at 25 degrees north. You do that for a handful of points, and you're able to, it's pretty crazy. You're able to interpolate the position down to like, sub 10 meter accuracy.
Amazing. So you're almost triangulating where you are based on what you're seeing. So it's, if I hear you right, Ian, it's kind of ironically super old school, in that like in literally millennia before GPS, the way human beings figured out where they were is like, oh, that mountain is off to the northwest, I can see. And oh, this river is to the south. Based on where the river is and based on the mountain is, I know here I am on the map. You're taking that same philosophy of just fucking looking around the world and then seeing where you are, but doing that in like a hyper granular way by having a drone capturing images while it travels and then real time figuring out where it is. Am I getting that basically right?
Dude, you're totally on the nose, and it's like, you made me think of two really cool things, which are, so that's literally how these like trained Ukrainian drone pilots fly today. Is because they don't have GPS at all. They're just looking at the feed, or they check it every 10 minutes, and they say, because we've talked to a lot of guys at this point, and they say like, oh, I know where that barn is, or I know where this house is. And then they pull up that that map, and then they replace where the drone is. So it would kind of be like if you had Google Maps all downloaded on your phone, and you had to like kind of look around the world, and then it's like, oh, okay, I see that pizza spot. And then you could like place yourself back on Street View, and do all the normal Google Maps operations. And so kind of the initial thing we were doing was super granular, like you also said. We're actually trying to, or something that we're exploring now is like zooming the lens out a little bit. Because when we think of granular, we think of like a river as being granular, but mm-hmm. to a computer, a river is like thousands and thousands of pixels, or hundreds, depending on the resolution. But like, so that's actually what we're trying to move to, is an understanding of like, yeah, this is a river that has this shape. This is a barn that is in this position, as opposed to like, you know, the first thing that we designed is literally like, oh, here is this corner of this barn, like match that. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't hold up as well when positions change, like drastically.
So am I right? This is a pretty fundamental breakthrough in how drones operate.
It's,
You can brag here. It's okay. Yeah. I could tell by your expression, listeners, Ian is struggling to make a very modest, self-deprecating, oh, it's no big deal expression. But am I right? This is fundamentally changing the structure of how drones operate, in a pretty massive shift in how, what drones could do.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, to toot my own horn a little bit, like if we really nail it, then yeah, this is huge. It's this massive opportunity. It's really a big deal. But it is just it's just a really hard technical problem. And so it was really cool for us, because we worked on it for a day. We put together something cool, and we heard a lot of people like saying this is really cool. which then got us in touch with the people that are kind of in the field or have been working on similar things. And so basically, we have what we're working on now is a pretty unique approach. And I personally believe has like really high potential. And we've got some customers that were like, are lined up to try it in the next month or two. That being said, it's more like that we kind of uncovered something that not very many people in America are familiar with. Hmm. Because the people that reach out and they're like, oh, whoa, this is like mind blowing. Like, this is really new. Like, they're all American. And it's not just not defense people. Like, people at the DOD are like, whoa, this is really cool. Drone companies, this is all really new to us in America. But people in Ukraine have been experiencing this for like a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk to those guys, that's like, oh, okay, you're really talking shop. Like, they know exactly, like, if we mention one thing, they're like, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. Like, next. So yeah, like it is a really, really, really big problem. And it's really important to future conflicts. But it's more like we kind of stumbled into something like really cool. Yeah.
As you point out, Ukraine is literally at the forefront of so much drone innovation. Is the tech you guys employed of have this kind of real-time drone using cameras to figure out where it is on the fly in lieu of a signal, is that something that's already in Ukraine or something people have thought about, but no one's actually doing yet? And they're like, huh, interesting.
Yeah. So there's two things. There's people that are trying to do it and nobody's like really nailed the solution. And there's a couple other companies out there. Yeah. That are working on it, but it's just like, okay. And they're really expensive, like really, really expensive. So that's the other thing that we kind of like inadvertently touched on is, you know, all the parts to put our drone together were $500. This first box that we're shipping out, this first box that we're going to be shipping out, is going to cost us under $1,000 with all of the, like all the fancy stuff. And the prices that, American defense companies are used to charging are just pretty outlandish for Ukrainians. And so we're coming in at like a tenth the price, a 30th the price of what other people are doing. And so that's what gets people really excited over there.
To your point of how you managed to somehow pull this off at such a cheap cost, you also pulled it off in an astonishing short amount of time, right? If someone came to me and said, I figured out a way to revolutionize how drones operate, they no longer need a signal. They no longer need GPS coordinates, which could potentially really change the game battlefield. If they told me it took 5 years to develop, I'd say, sounds about right. I said, okay, it took 5 years and $50 million to develop. Like, yeah, or 3 years, whatever it is, right? You and your team pulled this off in 24 hours. So now that we understand what's at stake and we understand a bit of what problem you guys are solving, talk a little more about how you're able to so quickly iterate. And then how is AI used? How did you use AI to rapidly speed up that process?
Yeah. We're just standing on the shoulders of giants. Like there's decades of really great work that is open source, that's available online, and that if you just fiddle with a little bit, can be applied in a bunch of places. Hmm. And when you combine that with LLMs as a programmer have, and I say this modestly, like 10x'd or 100x'd my ability over the past year and a half. And so we are just leveraged so hard to be able to solve hard problems, because like everything is hard. But one thing that I've found is the things that actually trip us up are really silly little things. And that just eats time. It's like, yeah, okay, coming up with some awesome algorithm on a whiteboard might take a day. But mm-hmm. then if you spend 4 hours setting up a file system or whatever, like those things compound. And basically, that's just kind of been removed. Like you can jump into a GitHub repository that some guy made a year ago and put up for free. And then you can just kind of stick the whole thing or the pieces that you need to understand into this machine and like just keep asking it like, okay, can you re-explain? Like, what should I'm trying to do this. And so it's like, we've all just become so much smarter. And what previously, I think, and this is just my perspective, but the value of like technical knowledge has really decreased. Like experience mm-hmm. is very valuable, and like intuition and going in the right places is really important. But then it used to be this immense value to being the guy that's like, oh, I know exactly the function that you should use in this C library. I know exactly how to write those four lines of Python that change from this file type to that file type or whatever. But we all have that now. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I would really credit like all of the speed to AI and then to the Celsius energy drinks.
Yeah. So when what time of day did this 24-hour clock start? And what was kind of like the any favorite memories or most painful memories of like the trickiest time? Like, holy shit, are we going to pull this off? Like, what was the toughest thing to overcome?
Yeah. Well, so I live in San Francisco. I flew down to LA at 6 a.m, which was really stupid. And then the hackathon kind of started at 2 p.m. And then like really we got started at maybe 4 or 5. So I had like taken a nap in a library before that and was like, yeah, so there's that aspect of just being tired. And yeah, I mean, at like 2 or 3 a.m, and I later found out like this guy's, the organizers of the hackathon, like flew this guy out specifically to like hype people up between like 2 and 6 a.m. And dude, it's awesome. He's literally playing like Teach Me How to Dougie and like, you know, like all sorts of like, you know, like I would say classic rap songs. Yeah. And just the energy was really, really high. If I had to say favorite moment, I mean, there was like a really great speech at the kickoff from she's a student at Stanford, but she was also Ukrainian, like, and a Ukrainian drone operator. And yeah, just like a really passionate speech about the importance of the work. And I think that that's something that everybody there was really feeling a lot, as opposed to, you know, a more traditional hackathon. It's like, no, like actually, if we nail this, like it makes a big difference. That's a really good feeling.
Yeah. To that point, Ian, how are you grappling? We've only met a couple of times, but I've been impressed from day one at how you seem to be a very thoughtful, introspective guy who for a while bounced around nomading, thinking about kind of the best way to deploy your skills and where to spend your time and energy and resources. And as you say, you kind of stumbled into this projects that could literally be used in war. It's also possible that you are Tony Starking a bit here, right? And are creating this weapon that in some contexts can be used for massive good, right? To defend Ukrainians, There's also a scenario where this tech gets into bad hands, right? And it could be used for ill. And obviously, this is stuff you've thought about, right? So how are you thinking about and thinking through what you're building and how it could be deployed and the people you're talking to and just your that overall place in that ecosystem?
Yeah, it's a really good question. One interesting phenomenon that I think applies across everything is when you're only worried about the macro if you're not actually building and if you're not in build mode. And so I there was a period of time right when we were getting started with this where we just had to talk to a bunch of people and figure out, like, are we really going to do this? And so that was kind of the last time I was really chewing on this. And then you kind of get down into the nitty gritty and you just aren't really thinking about it. But to kind of like zoom out and put that hat back on, I think at first it was really tough, and then I kind of just like thought about it more and came to the conclusion of like, okay, well, this is really useful to people today. It is a capability that like will at some point exist. And I don't know if like outside looking in, I buy that argument, but it's just like, okay, well, I would rather the first step in this direction be one that I believe in. And if it kind of, you know, if people co-opt something that you've designed later down the line, like that's kind of a different story. So I don't know if I have a great answer for it. One book that I read, this was like 6-9 months ago that I thought, and maybe I shouldn't draw this comparison, but it's called American Gun. And it's the whole story of the AR-15, like from before it was designed all the way through like past Sandy Hook into like the Las Vegas shootings. And like the creator of that, and I really hope that I don't create anything that goes on to be as controversial as that. But, you know, what they hammer even in this book, which is pretty sobering, is like that guy, Eugene Stoner, just wanted to help American troops in Vietnam. And like he just was tired of them having like shitty guns that got them killed in the field. You know, he did a really good job of working towards that. And so it's just like, if over the next 50 years, there's these long tail outcomes that happen, you know, that's a problem that we'll solve at another point. But just right now, the world is becoming less stable, and there are these smaller democratic nations that are right next to these like large adversarial powers. And when they go up against those powers, drones and cheap drones that work are the thing that keep them alive.
It would be a little unfair to go after the slingshot maker who built the slingshot that David used to help slay Goliath, right? If a slingshot is in the future used for ill, I think your point is well taken. One reason why I'm so excited to talk to you is you've been on the front lines of AI building and tinkering and creating in San Francisco. A couple of years ago, you were bouncing around or thinking of bouncing around the US. You came to the global nexus of AI startups. What's that been like? Like, what brought you there? And then talk about what the scene and vibe is like, right? I kind of have this like vision from articles, everyone's in bars in San Francisco talking AI all the time. Is that actually happening, right? So what's the energy and vibe like in San Francisco? And what did you find when you got there?
Yeah. First of all, yes, they definitely are. I was walking, I was in the park yesterday, just like passing two people, and you hear like blah blah, blah ML engineer, blah blah blah. Like it's everywhere. It really is. And yeah, the vibe is just really, really, really like this is the place to be. I mean, so what got me to come here was I had a company that I was trying to start. I wasn't even that sure on like what I was doing, but I was just really sure like, okay, I want to be building my own thing. And it's hard to do when people around you and the people that you know aren't doing that. And they aren't like, they aren't experimenting with the same things, or they're still in school, or they're, you know, right when you get out of school, I totally experienced this. It's like, well, shit, like I need to get a job. And then there's that stress and the stress of performing well there. And yeah, so it's like, oh my gosh, like who do I talk to about these things? Like I was trying to start a startup and I'm like scrolling through LinkedIn and messaging people I went to middle school with, like, hey, you know, you're smart. Like what, you know, do you want to chat sometime? And just really like not getting too much like positive feedback. And then my best friend and I started working on something. I was up in Montreal and we were actually like building something, and I realized like, oh my gosh, this is the only person that I'm friends with in the world that does these things that I'm really interested in. And I just had this aha moment of like, okay, well, where would be a better spot to go than San Francisco? Because I wasn't, like, I'd never been. I just kind of, like, watched the news and heard my dad. And it's like, oh, okay, I don't really want to check out San Francisco. It sounds lame. Like, I don't want to work at Google. But then it's like, well, I don't think there is anybody, like, any place with more people doing what I want to do than San Francisco. Yeah, and I got out here and was just, like, hit over the head with it. Like within the first week, I wasn't even sure. I thought I was going to be here for like a month. I ended up, I mean, I live here now. I was like crashing on couches. I was sleeping in the back of my truck, like staying at hostels, like just like literally whatever it took to just, yeah, like meet up with more people and just to be in spaces where, you know, like you and I met on a tennis court, which is like serendipitous and like really cool. Here you're constantly just running into people that like that, you know, you do some event together, you have lunch together, it's a friend of a friend. And so it's like networking without, there's no forcedness. It's just like, oh dude, that's really cool.
Without asking you to reveal your state secrets or your projects, you know, plans, given the hype and energy and capital floating around about AI right now, especially in San Francisco, how are you thinking about that? How are you thinking about, okay, there's a lot of VC action right now in this space. Awesome. Let's go for it. Or is it more like, ugh, is this, I just, that's a little overwhelming to think about. We just want to focus on creating cool shit. How is the kind of extreme energy and excitement in AI right now impact your roadmap of what you guys are trying to build?
Yeah, I'd heard this a bunch from other founders and really just experiencing it with Theseus, with this drone stuff we've been working on. It's just like, yeah, VCs, they get interested in stuff, but as a founder, like your job is to build stuff. And then at some point you raise capital to do it. And I think it's really easy, for people, myself included, to get lost in the sauce and feel like they need to go out and chase this money because it's there. But it's just like, realistically, you can be really lean. And we have taken some like venture capital, some like pre-seed money, but it's like, it just gets you so much farther now. And so it's like, Yeah, like the people that should be validating your product are like your customers, and not anybody else. And if you need more money to like find out more from the customers, like that's awesome. But it just isn't like, again, I think when I've been really in build mode, I just kind of like forget about the macro. And when I'm not, or when I'm not like bought into what I'm doing, then I'm thinking about like, oh, is this the right strategy? Am I like, min-maxing this, yada yada yada. But quite frankly, it's like it's actually a pretty clear line for me between like, oh, I'm doing something cool on one hand, or like, oh, I'm worried about like what people with like outside money think.
Last couple of questions as we wind down, two-parter. What excites you most about AI? And then how are you using AI in your own personal life aside from drone lands?
It just completely reshapes the way that everybody does work. It hasn't impacted my like leisure time very much, but it just feels like I'm pulling on this giant lever, and so many things that I want to be able to do, I'm now able to do, and it just really drives the cost of creating software down to very, very little. I was working on some really cool stuff with a friend, literally just outputting like whatever a YouTuber wanted, like we would just make it for him. And it's like, no, like we can actually just make that thing in like a week. Like the coding work is just, it's just gone. Yeah, and I'm struggling to see, I'm personally not interacting with AI in any way that isn't like work. And honestly, because I feel like my brain is so overclocked, like I try to just not touch a computer if I'm not like building something that I want to do or like getting paid.
Fair. Well, I think we should hit tennis courts sometime and get away from computers next time I see you. Well, thanks a lot, man. It was really great talking to you. Congrats on what you have built in an extremely like cartoonishly short amount of time. I can tell you are going places. Very exciting stuff. Thanks again. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. Super cool.
There you have it. Thanks again to Ian, my former tennis partner, now turned Tony Stark type figure in the world of drones and drone innovation in the military. Exciting stuff. And thank you to you, dear listeners. Hope you enjoyed. As always, please subscribe, rate 5 stars, and maybe send this episode to someone you know who's in the tech world, kind of starting out, someone in their 20s, 30s, young, hungry. I think this is a kind of a aspirational type story of Ian's, how he's what he's done so quickly. Thanks again, and see you next time.